This here goes down good with a tall tale.
This isn't playtime. This is serious business.
But the play must go on, I believe.
I'm always home. I'm on cool.
I've been thinking a lot about dying lately.
I'm trying to do good.
That's that.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of That's That, a Philip Seymour Hoffman retrospective podcast. My name is Timothy Mark Davis, and I'm your host. Today, we are talking about The Yearling, the 1994 TV movie directed by Rod Hardy. I hope you took the time to watch the film on Amazon Prime because it features a young Philip Seymour Hoffman in a much more substantial role than I was expecting, and I was very pleasantly surprised by how much he was in the film. My guest today is Miami-based actor, voiceover talent, and teaching artist, and one of my favorite people to wax cultural, philosophic, poetic, slash bullshit with, Carlos Alayeto. Carlos, how are you today?
I'm doing fantastic, Tim, and I could not ask for a better introduction. I would almost ask for it to be an epitaph. It really was something.
Today we're talking about The Yearling, and here is the logline from IMDb, along with some information about the film so we can place it in a little bit of context, and then Carlos and I will jump in. So here's the logline from IMDb. In 1870s Florida, a rural family struggles to survive. A lonely 12-year-old son, Jody Baxter, the lone surviving child, against his mother's better judgment, eventually persuades his parents to allow him a pet fawn, which Jody grows to love deeply. A bizarre run-on sentence for a logline, but we press on. Tragic conflict arises when the fawn begins eating the family's food crops.
Man, we're gonna have several problems with this.
I have a lot of problems with this logline.
I am suffering a small cerebral event. Listening to this?
This logline makes this film seem so inconsequential.
This logline reveals that no one who writes these things actually saw the darn movie.
Yeah, yeah.
First of all, it's not 1870s Florida. Let's just start right
it's
there.
It's not.
It's in the 1920s. One, the because there's automobiles in the town. Two, because the gravesite, we'll get to the dead children later, because there's several of
gosh.
Them. We'll get to the
so
dead
many,
children.
Too many to count.
They died in the 1920s, like 1919, 1920, 1921. So this is actually,
and
the sad thing about this logline is? It blows the incredible reality. You know, when you see the roaring 20s, they only ever show you the cities, Chicago, New York, all these really incredible bustling places. They never really show you, until you get to the Depression and the Dust Bowl, they never really show you what rural life was like in that post-World War I pre-Depression period.
Mm-hmm.
I love that this was set in Florida.
Me too. There's so much to love about this film that the logline does not capture.
It doesn't do it justice at all.
And this this is a 1994 CBS TV movie. So it already sounds like it's going to be terrible.
Right. It sounds like dreck. It sounds
or inconsequential.
But it reminds you that there was a time when TV movies had some real heft behind them.
Apparently.
I mean,
yeah.
This was a real film. And I was watching this and the quality of it. I mean, it didn't have that kind of like soap opera effect. It didn't.
It had sentimentality, which we reject now.
We
but
do.
It did not have
cynical.
Hallmark things going on.
It wasn't right. It was sentimental without being without
saccharine?
Being corny. It wasn't corny. It wasn't saccharine. It was very genuine and real. The performances in this film. I mean, honestly, it plays like a much older film than it actually is.
That's very true. Yeah, that's very true.
Not in the sense that it's presentational. On the contrary, there's this kind of like earnest type acting you start seeing in the late 60s and early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And you start seeing this kind. You see it a lot in Westerns and you see it in period pieces, but there's a lot of quiet moments in this film.
Yeah, there are. Yeah, I was a little bit more about, so this was directed by Rod Hardy, who I'm not really familiar with, but he has a long directing career, primarily in TV, a lot of television episodes, a lot of TV movies. It's based on the 1938 novel by the same name, which was written by Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings, which won the 1939 Pulitzer Prize for the novel. So it's standing on some strong literary shoulders. Have you read the book? I've never read the book.
I remember the book being on several reading lists.
Okay.
I kind of want to read it now. No, I do want to read it because there are several characters that I know for a fact were severely underdeveloped in this film.
Sure.
Fodder Wing being one of them because...
Fodder Wing.
And we'll get into that because that's a character that's only featured, just for some context. Fodder Wing is, if I may, Tim.
Go for it.
He's basically one of the youngest children of the foresters who are the neighbors of the main family that we are following
in
the film.
And Buck Forrester is the Philip Seymour Hoffman role.
Exactly. So Buck Forrester, right, that's the PSH character.
Yes.
And so this Forrester family, now when we're talking about neighbors, we're not talking about they live next door. We're talking about these people live in the swamp and a 2-mile slog away. And those are the closest people they live to.
Yep.
And the Forresters are moonshiners. So they have a big, big house. I mean, not a big, nice house, but a big house. And there's a bunch of them running around that place. And they look like what you think moonshiners would look like.
Oh, yes.
And this boy, Fodderwing, they called him Fodderwing because he covered himself in basically animal fodder and chicken feathers and jumped off of like the second floor of the barn. And then he fell and apparently he got a head injury and he became physically disabled.
Yeah.
They use a different word for that, obviously.
Yes.
And he runs around on a crutch and he's obsessed with animals and collecting wild animals. And he's got his family, he says, he always had a way with them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he tames skunks and raccoons and all of this is just wonderful. And he is Jody, who is the boy protagonist. He's his kind of like his best friend.
Yep. His only friend, really.
Right. But the only thing we see of that is them riding along on this raft. Very
first
Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn. Beautiful. Yep. Oh, by the way, the cinematography, they really shoot the nature of this, don't they?
Yeah, and they capture the geography. So the other thing that I thought was interesting is that it's also a remake of the 1946 film by the same name that starred Gregory Peck and Jane Wyman as Penny and Ori Baxter, which that's Jody's parents, the protagonist family's parents. And both of them were nominated for Oscars for their performances. So I'm kind of interested in going back and looking at that early film as well, just to see how these massive themes, which I don't want to get too close to it yet because we'll get sucked in,
but the
massive themes that this movie explores, what did that look like in 94? What did that look like in 46? And what does that look like in the source material? But a little bit more about sort of the cast and the context for the film. The film stars Will Hernoff as the lead, Jody Baxter, who I recognized as the bully kid from the mean team in The Sandlot. Do you remember these kids?
Oh my gosh, yes.
They wear the uniforms and they're such little jerk-offs. And that's him.
In the way that only 90s like mean team kids could be.
Yes, yes, exactly.
So good.
So Peter Strauss plays Penny Baxter, which is Jody's father. And the wonderful Jean Smart plays Ori Baxter.
Oh my gosh, what a star turn for her.
Yeah. So this is me excellent. Just being a 90s kid here, but I recognized her from Homeward Bound.
Yes.
And Snow Day and The Kid. And this is how you know that I'm younger than you.
Well,
because I don't even know
women.
That you've seen some of those kids movies, but
of course.
She's had quite the career outside of and this is where I'm like, oh, I look at people's IMDBs and I feel so dumb. It's like, okay, I saw their movies, their 90s Disney movies. But she's got 120 acting credits. She's won Emmys for turns in Frasier. She was in the recent Watchmen series that's on HBO that I have not seen, but I really want to watch.
Yep.
So an impressive actor who does some great work in this film as well.
You know, she's got chops and they're on full display here.
Yes.
I mean,
for
she
sure.
goes, it's a hard row to hoe because she's got she's just tough as nails.
Mm-hmm.
Just for a little context, her character, her backstory is so tragic. You know, she's got this, the film opens and you see her and she's tending what appears to be a small garden.
Yeah.
But it's not a garden at all. Well, it is a garden, but the garden is filled with several headstones of the previous children that she lost. And
it's a garden and a grave, which just hit me. Wow. That is the metaphor for the film.
Yeah.
Right there. It's the first thing.
See how quickly we can get there?
Wow, we got there so fast.
Well, you know, one of the things that hangs over her character the entire film is there's an emotional distance that she keeps from Jody that makes her more the disciplinarian than the father.
Yep.
And it comes down to the fact that that's her way to protect herself because she's learned not to get too attached to her kids.
Yeah.
Because she basically came to terms. I mean, it's three children. One, two, three. She loses them all. And Jody is the only one that... And this is the thing that I feel is kind of like the pregnant pause for her. He's just about to hit, like, adolescence.
Yep.
So the whole theme of becoming a man and manhood and the rite of passage, it for her, it's almost like...
No.
This is the most terrifying. Will he make it?
Yeah.
Like, is something going to take him before he can even get to that point?
Yep.
And that's hanging over her the entire film.
Yeah.
And she says as much. I mean, you know, this is one thing we have to say about this film is they really do a great job of kind of telling you everything that's going on. In the dialogue, but not in a cheesy way.
Yeah. How on earth did they accomplish that? Because this just has like cheesy, expositional, bad dialogue written all over it. But somehow with the combination of period piece, the geography, the accent work, it's like, yeah, sometimes they're saying on the nose things.
I've been here in a long time. And it's like, thank you for telling us that. That was really for our benefit.
Yeah, it doesn't ruin it though. I don't know. Because something about the style works.
Because it's how do you couch it in the reality of the moment? You know, you can get exposition in without anybody knowing that that's what it is. And I think that's just really good writing. It's just really tight.
Yeah, you know? It is.
And the scenes are always you know, you got interactions with people, people talking to one another. A lot of it's transactional, which is really interesting. There's a lot of focus on trading.
Yeah.
And bartering to get what you want.
Yeah.
And you know, even the relationship that the Baxter family has with the Foresters is almost largely transactional. Yeah. They are friends because they do things for each other.
Right.
And
the reason they do it is to survive, that's something that I want to get into as well. Is this like what did I write? I like wrote down a comment that I was like, I have to read this to. There were two things that stuck out to me. It was like, life is characterized for these people by avoiding death oftentimes. Whereas so much of my life is characterized by how delicious my next meal will be. Like I just felt watching this. I felt so.
You just feel like trash, don't you? You're like,
yeah, I do.
Well, this is that film that says, when I was your age, I walked to school uphill in the snow both ways.
Yes.
That is that. And
it's
true. This is that in a movie.
Yes. And it's true.
You
know what else was funny? Is like people are dying from snake bites and fevers and there's a hurricane. I was like, this is a 2020 Florida movie.
Like, well, this
is a film. It feels so relevant.
Right. Except. Okay, you can get into a car. Let's say you get bit by a copperhead, which is an endemic South Florida venomous snake.
Yeah.
Let's say you get bit by a copperhead, right? And you get in the car and you go to the ambulance and they take you to the hospital and they get you some anti-venom and maybe it hurts a bit, but you'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see the doctor in this? This was the typical doc booze. I have showed up. You know, three sheets to the wind, and I'm going to spend the night here probably because I can't make it back to my house.
Yeah.
But if he survives the night, that was the best part.
Oh, that was a great line.
If he survives the night, he'll live. That's the guarantee.
That's so the diagnosis from the doctor.
Right. Which is also, I get to sleep over and not walk all the way back home miles away where I live. Right.
So I can, in the morning, I can be like, well, I told you, or I told you. It's like either way.
And then
way.
He goes, I've been wanting some breakfast before I leave.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I know. The mooch. He's in the right business. Gosh. What a time to be a doctor when you don't have to know anything. You just got to show up and get a meal.
You got to show up with a bag. Leather bag and, and a stern countenance.
Oh, it's so true. But my final point of context that I want to throw in here, and this is why we're here. This is Philip Seymour Hoffman's 10th film. He plays Buck Forrester, the local yokel, neighbors of the Baxters. Phil would have been 26 or 27 when he shot this film. And in terms of placing it in his career around some larger films, this is 2 years after Son of a Woman, which is sort of considered his breakout role.
Right.
And 2 years before Twister, which is a
only
cult
2 years
favorite.
Before Twister? Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Oh, my 96. God, I'm old.
And then Boogie Nights is 97. So he's,
wow.
Yeah, he's right in this, like, okay, I've done Son of a Woman. I've got my name out there, but I'm not ready to make the full leap. I've got to keep doing lesser known, smaller work. And you see that in the rest of his filmography as well. And so he ends up in a TV movie, which sounds like a bad thing, but he is so good in this.
He's funny.
He's so good.
Because it's just and what I love about it is it's one of those performances where the minute you see him on camera, you know he matters.
Yeah.
You don't even know who he is yet, really.
Yep.
Because they don't really introduce him. You see him kind of
But they give him a couple close-ups.
Exactly.
Yep.
It's like the cameraman, the cinematographer knew. It's like, I just need to frame this kid standing around, and you're going to know that he's going to mean something later. And the payoff is so satisfying, especially if you're a PSH fan, because
oh my God,
he lets out such a wide range. What it's funny is, and I love watching actors across their career for this reason, because, and you know this as an actor yourself, you see them doing the same things in the sense that how they express anger, how they express frustration.
Which I've stolen from him.
How they laugh at things, you know? How he laughs at things. If you ever watch PSH, he laughs at things almost the same way in every film. But you know why he does that? Because that's real. Because you laugh the same way at things all through your life. And that's what makes a good actor. he's himself. He is PSH.
He's got that weird, and that's one of the things that I love about him, and I love that you're bringing this up. There is this, like, there's these technique points, and, like, yes, the laugh is one of them, the register and the quality of his voice when he's angry is one of them, the hands on the hips thing, if you've seen the stills of him with hands on his hips in so many films.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
There's probably a supercut on the internet.
Nobody puts their hands on their hips better than Philip Seymour Hoffman. He's got these things that are essentially him.
Mm-hmm.
But then you look at the filmography and the vastness of type and quality and types of people. It's just like, it's astounding to me.
Do you know what you're reminding me of?
That's why I love him.
No, he it's phenomenal. But it's funny, now I'm going to date myself because, you know, as a kid who...
Old man Alayeto, really here we go.
You remember Quantum Leap?
No.
Okay, Quantum Leap was this, it was a sci-fi series with Scott Bakula and Dean Stockwell. And basically, it was this guy who was a scientist who worked on time travel. And every episode was basically, there's an accident and he gets stuck traveling through time. But the way he travels through time is his consciousness leaps into the bodies of different people through time.
Oh my God.
So what's amazing about
this
it is
what I want.
Okay.
I don't know what you're getting at, but I want that power.
Okay. Watch. So he leaps into these bodies and everybody in the time period sees the person they're supposed to be seeing. They don't see Scott Bakula. They don't see Sam, the character.
Yeah.
And it's funny because what they'll do is, like, let's say he leaps into the body of a woman. You'll see him in drag the whole episode because he's this woman. Right?
Wow, yeah.
Because he's inhabiting that body.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm getting at is you are all these different people, but you're still yourself.
Yes.
So you're
the paradox
still
yourself. Of acting.
Yes. You're yes. still yourself in all these different situations. And the masterful actor is able to do this. They are able to transcend self and still retain self.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
You see?
What is that? That is the juice that I that want is, to drink. It's just
that
amazing.
That is the fruit of the gods. That is the ambrosia. That is what you yearn for.
Yes. Oh,
where you could.
God.
But the thing is, the only way you can really accomplish that is through experience.
Yeah.
You can't do that in one role.
No.
Because you don't know if you're, that was just a one-off. That's just what that person did once.
It's all about the canon.
Right. You really need to be able to, this is the beautiful thing about, you know, having longer careers and doing a lot of projects,
mm-hmm.
is you have the opportunity to hone in on what is uniquely you and kind of transplant that from experience to experience to experience.
Yeah.
Right? And we see this. This is why you can see an Al Pacino film and see things that are uniquely Pacino. And I'm not talking about like, all that, loud Pacino toward the end.
Yes.
No, I'm talking about like 70s Pacino, Dog Day Afternoon Pacino, author. But like you see, and he's in all of these different, completely crazy situations, but it's still Al Pacino and you're still enthralled.
Yep.
And PSH is one of those actors.
Yeah,
that
he is.
It's still PSH and it's uniquely him. And I know you're going to talk about The Master, but to me, that was kind of like the culmination of all of that.
Oh, yeah.
Because, and you're going to, whatever, not to get too far off on it, but that film basically is like this, he is the master.
Yep.
He's the master actor.
Yep.
And you're seeing all of the restraint. And all of the, whatever. Mm-hmm. Wrong podcast. We're going to talk about this.
you bring that. I mean, by the time this comes out, when we're recording this, the master episode is going to drop in a couple days. But when this comes out, people will have heard the master episode. And so this is repetitive at this point. But
it in education, we call it scaffolding. We're scaffolding.
Scaffolding. There you go. it is the peak performance. You know, it culminates, his life culminates in that film performance.
Mm-hmm.
And it captures so much of exactly what you're talking about is captured in that performance. But someone can't get there without doing something like The Yearling 20 years before, where it's a character part, it's a deep accent, it's not the lead, it's a supporting role, there's not some huge arc, but there is an arc. That's what I was surprised. I thought he was going to have one scene in this movie and he was going to be like a bad guy, you know, that was like my assumption, and he is more complex than that. And
well,
not the bad guy at all, ultimately.
To give a little context to the plot for any of the listeners that might not have seen this, the Foresters, as was mentioned before, are moonshiners, right?
Yeah.
Which, you know, look, this is kind of one of those situations where, you know, the Baxters are moral and good to a fault. There is no moral fa- That's, I think that's something that's very important.
Yeah.
Penny Baxter is the greatest. You wish he was everybody's father. He's the greatest man that ever lived. Like,
yeah,
that's one of the things that really touched my heart about this film, because you see a lot of negative portrayals of fatherhood. This man was just so, and the thing that that was so great about him was he was so warm and open-hearted with his boy.
Yeah.
Which is something you
affection.
Don't ever see in fathers. Yeah, but and not just, he would give him hugs. He would kiss his son. He would cuddle with him. You know, he would tell him, things that were confessions of how he felt.
Yeah,
you know, about lots of things. Well, I think we'll get into that later.
I hope I'll be a man just like you, Pa. Oh, I got more hope for you than that, son.
Oh my God!
Like, can you believe those lines?
Ah. And the way he said the whole getting back, well, we're going to get to that, the big monologue at the end, but it's like the whole thing about you don't want to grow up and see them guts tore out.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah. No, we're going to play that monologue for,
you know,
for
and as a dad, I don't know how old your kids are, but when I heard that, I just thought about my daughter and
it wrecked me. Yeah.
Things that we go through in life. And, you know, there's hard things that you need to face as you grow up, illness, death, things like this. And you always hope, how can I protect my children from this? And the truth is, you're not supposed to.
I know.
You have to be there so that they can see it, and you have to be able to guide them through it.
Yeah.
You can't, you know, and that's I think one of the great, and I hate to, you know, kind of blow the wad so early on it, but
oh, do it. It's fine. We're
there. For that arc, it's this whole realization of, I can't keep you from the harshness of this world. I can't. I tried. The yearling,
we haven't even said what the yearling is.
The yearling, by the way, is a name for one of the early events in the film that sets up the action. Is they go on a hunting expedition because there's this subplot with this bear.
Slewfoot.
Old Slewfoot.
All right, boys, we'll go to town. We'll tow old Slewfoot along with us. If they don't want us, they can throw us out! If they can!
So that's when they finally do get Slewfoot. And that was Philip Seymour Hoffman.
That elation.
Yeah.
You could plug that same feeling into his character in Boogie Nights.
Yes, yes.
Like when he's just happy.
Uh-huh.
You know, that kind of like happy-go-lucky, I'm thrilled.
Yeah.
That is one of those kinds of things that he does where he just starts getting into it. He is just happy, you know?
Oh, Slewfoot!
Well, Slewfoot is a big brown bear, right?
Yes.
That
is eating their animals. It's horrible. It's death. Slewfoot is death.
Well, Slewfoot is death. He's the specter of the cruelty of nature.
Yes.
Because nature is so cruel in this film. And you see, that's one of the reasons why you asked me, we were talking earlier about whether I had seen it with my family or not. And I was going to, but in the end, I'm glad I didn't. And I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
This film does not give a crap about your feelings regarding animals. It does not care.
No.
This film, for all of you cat
so many dead dogs.
Dog dads out there, this is not for you. Because this film, you know, and it's kind of a lot like the way I grew up. I did grow up on a farm for a little while when I was a kid.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, animals, there's a relationship with, you know, humans and animals that's very, very different with the agrarian society than it is with the city folk. You know, if you've got pigs, it's because you're going to eat them one day.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got chickens, one day you're, you know, my father would tell me about a story in Cuba. He had a pet duck, and then one day the duck was gone, and he didn't realize that's what they were eating for dinner that night. Like that's, and so the yearling.
But that's the Baxters are different there though. But yeah. Go ahead with the yearling.
Well, wait a minute. The Baxters are different. In that, well, they have, but even the dogs are hunting dogs.
The dogs are expendable.
And no, he trades it for a new gun to go hunt Slewfoot.
Yep.
And even that whole scene where they negotiate for the gun is the best reverse psychology ever. The way he goes in, he's like, oh, I don't know if I want to do it. And the entire, that was his entire purpose, by the way. That if you want to see a great scene in how to negotiate for what you want by communicating the opposite, watch that scene. Where
That's
he
so
trades
true.
The dog for the gun. And
he sticks to it. He sticks
to
it the whole time.
Poker
I was like, oh my
face?
Gosh, this guy.
You know why? Because survival is on the line.
Yeah.
You know, if he doesn't get that gun, old Slewfoot is going to keep killing all of their livestock. So this bear, Slewfoot, is like the terror of that part of the swamp.
Yep.
And they go on a hunt. And it's
the first
Jody's
time they
first,
go out.
First hunt. So he goes out with his father. And they corner Slewfoot, and just as his father is going to fire on him, the gun jams.
Yeah.
And in Slewfoot gets away. One of the dogs gets, you know, scratched up real bad. That was the first hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second hunt, you're right, is two hunts. On the second hunt, and that's where the whole setup for the gun trading scene, that's when he realized, I got to get a new gun.
Yeah.
They go out the second time. And he gets bit by a rattlesnake, Penny Baxter, Jody's father. So,
which is certain death.
Certain death.
And they play that. That was shot.
No,
that was amazing. Yeah. It's like he got bit and they're immediately sobbing. He's going to die.
Yeah. I mean, the boy, him, everybody knows. And then out of the thicket, out of the woods, appears this doe. Mm-hmm. And this is funny because I didn't understand it at first. When,
me neither.
When the doe appears, he said, "You got to shoot it, Jody. It's our only chance."
Yeah, I was like, "What?"
And I go, "What do you mean?" First, the father shoots the snake, which was incredible. So he's yes. snake bit, sitting there yes, like with dealing one arm. With like one arm. He gets the new rifle. He shoots the snake. So the yeah. snake's no longer a threat, but now we got the poison. So then this doe comes out and he tells the boy, "You got to kill the doe." "Dad, I can't." He goes, "It's our only chance." So I think, oh, well, they need food because the pigs were stolen. They've got no meat and they're in trouble, right?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too.
Right. So I'm like, "Oh, okay, you can shoot it for meat." No.
Like, you're thinking a little far ahead here, Pop, for your current right. situation. But I appreciate the foresight, but...
Yeah, this is a strange time to be hungry, Dad. But... But the boy does as he's instructed by the apotheosis of fatherhood.
Yes.
And he shoots the doe and then he goes, "I need its liver and its heart."
So I was the like, boy, okay, what are we doing?
Cuts the liver and the heart
yeah.
from the doe to use it as a sponge to sop up the venom from the wound of his father's arm.
Mm-hmm.
So they do this backcountry medicine, which. Yes. works and may have saved his life or not.
He
we don't know. But
the venom out. He,
I want to believe that these people knew what they were doing because yeah, they're too. Living out there.
Yep.
So yep. that doe is the mother of the yearling, and the yearling was her fawn.
Yes.
So Jody thinks it's
compassionate. Jody.
Oh, the boy is the sweetest. He's
such a
so
good heart.
Lovely.
Yeah, he is.
He's lovely without being sappy.
Yeah.
It's just a genuine goodwill.
There's an innocence there. That's not detestable.
There is a beautiful innocence, which is of course, it's part of the arc of Jody's
Correct.
As well.
Right.
And that's what the yearling is. He's this fawn, and he negotiates to keep it as a pet, and the father allows it, but the mother is dead set against it from the beginning.
Yep.
And the father has this moment with the mother where he tells her, you know, "Didn't you ever have a pet? I want the boy to be, it makes him happy." And she's yep. like, "We don't have any food to feed any pets," which automatically tells you every animal here is serving a purpose because every animal here takes away from the food that we need to survive.
Yep.
So if the animal, the mother is so purpose, that's what she is. She is purpose driven.
Yeah.
Purpose.
Very pragmatic.
Oh, well. Like you need to be.
Yeah, I've lost three kids. What else
I've
am I
I've lost
gonna...
three children. Yeah. This may be the fourth. Pardon me for not having high hopes for this one.
Right.
Especially when you go out and you take him hunting every other day and he runs around in this, you know, swamp. And why are we... There's a moment where she's talking with Penny towards the last 75% of the film. She's like, "What are we doing out here?"
Yeah, we
and,
should
and
move.
This whole romantic idea that Penny has of, "I came out here because I wanted to find a little peace."
Yeah. Oh, man.
Ugh. Again, man. I'm going to tell you, Tim, I have to thank you so much for... This is a film that, if not for you and this podcast, would have gone completely unseen.
Oh, me too. I would never watch this if not for
no,
doing this
ever.
Podcast.
No, ever. With that log line, with that garbage log line.
Horrible log line.
Horrible log line.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a disservice. It makes you want to write like a, I would like to write a letter to IMDb logliners.
Yes.
You have done a great disservice to this small piece of American art.
Yes, you have. So, I mean, just to sort of wrap up the plot, I mean, there's this whole Slewfoot subplot going on. He's stealing the animals. They ultimately get Slewfoot and they
and
run
that
into the
scene
foresters.
That you played,
that's right. from after they've gotten him and the foresters are like, "Okay, we'll be the one that skins him." And they're all going to the doings, you know, the church doings. And we haven't
yes.
talked about Lem Forrester, who is sort of this antagonist figure. He's Buck's brother, Philip Seymour Hoffman's brother in the film. He's a drunkard, he's a scoundrel. He is a jealous, jealous man. He is the opposite of Penny Baxter in every single way. So they skin this bear, and I just got to play this clip.
"This here's the head of old Slewfoot! And Penny Baxter's the man to lay him low!"
So when Philip Seymour Hoffman came into the doings, which is this church gathering around Christmas where they're dancing with the bear hide, I almost fell out of my bed. I was laughing so hard. I was like, I can't believe this golden nugget of cinematic moment has been kept from me for this many years. It is so funny and kind of random, but also perfect.
No, no, it is that. And again, it's that joyful PSH. Yes. It's the same joy that you see in other performances. And now he's running in with the bear hide.
I know.
And it's totally believable and it's not out of place. Yeah. And what's incredible is also the reaction of the crowd is not disgust. It's not shock. They're like, oh yeah, they got Slewfoot. There he is. And everybody stands and they applaud Penny Baxter. They start to clap. The whole town is applauding and he gets this hero's welcome. And of course, Lem.
Yeah.
Lem, who, by the way, they do nothing to make this man affable. He is just repugnant.
He's a villain.
He's pale. He's almost, he's purple. He's got Jim Blossoms on his nose. Yeah. I mean, the guy is just, and the funny thing is they never really give a reason for his malice. Like they never say that, he's just unrepentantly a bastard from the moment you see him. He like pushes around Jody, who's like half his size. And he's a little kid.
Yeah. Well, he steals their hogs.
He steals the pigs.
At the beginning of the movie.
Yes. And which, by the way, which then PSH in the height of his arc calls it. He lets us know that's what. Now,
I'm going to play this clip, too.
Please. Because
people got to hear this. So
they got to
early in the film, the Foresters, seems like mostly Lem, steals the hogs. Lem is this villain. The other brothers and Fodderwing are like, no, we need to be friends with them. We're friends with them. Buck, it's kind of like pulling away from his brother, but also you got to protect your brother.
So blood loyalty is important in this
film.
Yes,
of course, of course. So they finish this church doings thing. And then Lem, as you were just about to get to, is so angry. Him and Penny end up in a fist fight. Finally, it gets broken up. And Lem is thrown out of the church doings where he unhooks the wagon wheel of the Baxter. I mean, it's just like the things this guy does.
Horrible.
So the Baxters get home. They've tied up the wagon because Jody saw it happen. He saw Lem do this and they fixed it. They made it home, but then it snaps and it runs over Penny's foot and the kid is pissed and he runs over to the Foresters. And he confronts Lem, and this is what Philip Seymour Hoffman. This is the end of his
arc. I love
this
moment.
It is beautiful.
So satisfying.
That's what the boys say, true, Lem. He's a liar. Just like his daddy.
My daddy, he never told a lie in his life. And I ain't lying either. I saw you under that wagon.
Stealing the hogs is bad enough, Lem.
This is more than I could stomach. I'd rather have me, an honest and friendly neighbor, than a sneaking low-down coward
for a brother!
Come on, boy.
Oh, I mean,
that rage.
The choices, though. Like, and this is where part of what I do is, like, I look at the way that Phil says certain lines and I'm like, okay, if I was given that line, my initial reading would be like, you know, I'd rather have good neighbors than a low down coward for a brother, you know, and just like keep it sort of this contained and, or do like the slow arc to the end. You know what I mean? But he does this. It feels so alive, so intuitive. And all
because
of a sudden
he knows
he's
where the insult is. He know the insult is coward. So he puts all of his rage into that's the arrow.
Yep.
The arrow is you're a coward. You know, you do this underhanded thing. The guy, you know, bests you in one-to-one combat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, that was the other thing. Oh, we didn't mention that. So during the fight in the doings, the other brothers are going to jump in to help Lem, who's getting beaten by Penny.
Yeah.
And PSH, Buck, holds his brother back and says, it's not your fight.
Yeah.
Let these, you know, and that's when you start to see that, you know, they set up from the beginning that the Foresters are not to be trusted. They're right. set up to be this shadowy, sinister force. And then you see, and because of Lem, and Lem really is the source of all of the troubles in this film, because at the end of the day, they go out on a hunt for Slewfoot because the hogs, it took the sow, and it wasn't really the bear that took the sow. It was that this guy stole the pigs.
Right.
And then, you know, the poor father is just like the sacrificial lamb.
Mm-hmm.
They hurt him so much. That guy suffers so much pain in this film.
Yeah.
But
he does
run over and snake bites and this guy.
Yeah, it's brutal.
but it's PSH
that moment. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say he becomes the moral authority and the leader of the foresters.
Yeah.
And it's funny because you see the foresters, you see their parents, and it's an older woman and a much older man. I mean, they look like Jed Clampett and and grandma.
Yeah.
So you could see they're not strong enough to stand up to Lem.
Right.
But they do visibly disapprove of him.
Yes.
And
they're afraid.
They're afraid of him. Well, they're afraid of his rate.
And then Buck finds his.
He finds his
manhood, really.
It's exactly. He decides, I need to be the head of this family.
Yeah.
To the point where at the end, he exiles Lem.
Yep.
To Kentucky. That's that whole wonderful scene at the end.
Yeah.
And it closes. I love how they close the scene. You just said something brilliant. This is why they did it. The closing scene is Buck and Jody. They've both become men in their families.
Yeah. Wow. That's true. Yep.
You know, and again, like you said, a film where you think, oh, and Philip Seymour Hoffman as Buck. Oh, how nice. He had a couple of months off and he did this little part.
Right.
No, he's got it's another one of those films where
it's also comedic. He hits the comedy and the drama perfectly in this.
Well, that's where the pathos lies, right? Like somewhere in between. He's not this one-dimensional character. You see joy, you see rage, you see disgust, you know. You see so much range. And he's in the film for what, 10 minutes?
Probably. Yeah.
Maybe five or six scenes. Yeah, this is one of those films where, like, you know, Jack Nicholson and Anthony Hopkins won their Oscars in less than 20 minutes of screen time apiece.
Right. Yeah.
This is one of those films where, and the daytime Emmy goes to Philip Seymour Hoffman. You're like, he was in the film for 10 minutes. Watch those 10 minutes.
Yep. There's this clip of him talking about acting that I want to play.
Please.
Because it was the one that stuck out for this role. So here we go.
To me, that's acting. I mean, it's not necessarily to be real or natural, but to be honest and expressive and creative. And I think if you're those things, people identify with what they see, or they're surprised by it or shocked by it or something, they have an experience with it, instead of watching something that, well, I think there's a difference between being surprised by it and identifying with it and all those things, as opposed to kind of being comfortable with the distance that some acting can create, which meaning like, you know that it's acting, and sometimes it's very well done, but you know you're watching something that's not really pertaining to their lives. You know, it's fiction, it's fantasy, and I'm much more interested in dealing with what's happening, you know, in people's lives. So.
And this is him talking about acting 10 years later, and I hear that clip and I'm like, oh man, he's been doing this expressive, creative, like, I'm not trying to be real or natural, I'm trying to be honest. You know, like bringing it back to those ideas and actually do things that are surprising. It's like, oh man, he practices what he preaches.
Well, honesty is surprising because most people aren't.
Yeah, that's very true.
They can't be for one reason or another. I mean, there's so many situations where one has to, you know, either be artificial. And I think that's one of the things that this film does. And this is why, and you mentioned it should be a treat to read the book. The author is a woman.
Yeah.
And one of the things this film does a great job of is kind of destroying this myth of the stoic male.
Yes.
The male that does not express their emotions. Every man in this film expresses a range of emotions.
Yep.
You know, you see men cry in this film. You see men, you know, feel weak and feel powerless and feel regret. Mm-hmm. And you see them feel just this range of emotions. And the stoic one is the mother figure.
Yeah.
Until she finally breaks down and says, you know, to the father, you know, you have basically been living this romantic fantasy and I'm keeping us alive.
Mm-hmm.
The whole, you know, and the whole thing at the end where, so to, I don't know how much you care about the plot at this point, but to put a button on it, basically what happens at the end is there is this big hurricane and it washes away all of their crops. Now, when I'm talking about crops, guys, this is not a giant field of corn like you would see. Yeah,
this is like what we're going to be able to eat.
Right. This is like 15 shoots of corn in like a 10 square foot area. Like this is not a big crop. So this hurricane comes and they're in the rain and the rain basically floods everything out. So they decide they have just a few months to plant another crop so they can harvest it before winter comes so they don't starve. I mean, these are the stakes. It's not a minor deal. So this first, this crop happens that was supposed to be the crop to save them. And guess who's eating the newborn corn? The yearling.
The yearling.
Which has already grown up and has been with
the yearling.
Flag the yearling, named by Fodder Wing. With in a beautiful little speech, by the way, by the actress that played Mrs. Forrester. It's just a lovely little heartfelt moment when they're doing the eulogy. Oh, that was another thing.
The Lord is hard.
Jody goes to visit. This happens in the first 20 minutes of the film. He goes to visit. That's why I believe in the book there's got to be more to that character, because they kill off Fodder Wing in like 15, 20 minutes. Yeah. You see him hobbling around a bit, and he's like, oh, look how cute Fodder Wing is. And then he's dead from some unidentified swamp fever that kills people. So, which, who knows?
A virus, if you will.
Right. You know, one of those viruses that, you know, people used to believe in. And
long ago.
Right. So this, so he dies, and basically, before, one of the last things he said before he died was he described the yearling's tail like it was a little flag.
Yeah,
and it was just this beautiful speech, right? And of course, oh, this is the other thing that I just remembered. Penny Baxter is the one that eulogizes Fodder Wing.
Yeah.
Because Mr. Forrester, the father, the old man, he says, well, you were raised a Christian. Could you please say a few words at the burial of Fodder Wing? So Lem doesn't even get to do that for his own dead brother.
Yeah.
This is why this hatred of Penny... It's like, this man is the shining example of everything I'm not and never will be.
Yeah.
He even gets to say the last words for my own blood brother. But anyway, to the end happens where, you know, at this point, as you said earlier, Tim, Penny Baxter, his foot was run over by the carriage. So he's laid up. He can't do anything. And it's basically Jody and the mom running the farm. Yeah. So Penny says, your mom and I talked. And the deal is you need to shoot the deer, because now that the deer has tasted corn, nothing will stop it from coming back and eating it again.
Yeah. It's not like you can set it free.
Right. It's going to come back. Right. It won't leave and it knows where the food is. So what the conflict is.
And Jody won't do it, of course. Jody won't do it.
Jody can't do it because it's his friend. So what happens? Tell us what happens.
Mom does it. Mom shoots the deer and Jody freaks out. He says to Dad and Mom, but mostly Dad, I hate you. I never want to see you again. He runs into the woods after the deer. The deer is greatly injured. He ends up putting it down because it's suffering. And then he's out there in the wilderness, no food, no water, struggling, and kind of has his coming of age moment. He comes back home. His mom has gone out looking for him. Mom and Dad have talked. She's finally confronted him and been like, this is what you, look what you've set up. You've made me the hard one. And I knew that this was going to happen with this deer from the beginning. So they kind of have their reconciling moment. She's out looking for him. Jody comes back home and it's this prodigal son moment, of course.
So beautiful.
He's so happy to see him. He says there's biscuits and honey over there.
Oh, the father doesn't even admonish him. He doesn't even scold him.
It's totally prodigal son. He's like, put on my best robes. There's a feast in here.
Yes. It's
a beautiful moment.
Well, speaking of, if there's one thing I could say about this film as a whole, it's very well crafted.
Yeah.
The world building is strong. I mean, whoever their dialect coach was, they didn't pay him enough. The dialects in this film were legendary. Yeah. Consistent, so good. To me, it's what I live for. It's beautiful work. It's like some of my favorite work is dialect work like that.
Yeah.
Just delicious to listen to.
Yeah.
But this film, does the theme of the prodigal son, but it also does the theme of, it's like, you know, when you look at, I don't know if you've ever read Hagiography, The Lives of the Saints, but in The Lives of the Saints, there's always the moment where there's a moment of exile and return.
Yeah.
Where the prophet,
the hero's journey,
they go out into the desert and they starve and they suffer. And and that's where they experience the spiritual awakening. Yeah. That's where they come to the realization. It's when they've left behind all of the comforts and left behind everything that they're used to.
Jesus and, fasting in the wilderness for 40 days.
And he wasn't the first to do it.
No, he wasn't.
He wasn't the first. Yeah. Many prophets before him did it. Mm-hmm. And this is a theme. And it is an important theme because... And they do this in this movie that was made by CBS for TV.
I know. My it's God. So crazy. It's There's and so so, so Jody is he's stuffing his face with biscuits and dipping it in honey. And one of the things he yells as he's heading off when he's trying to break relationship with his family is you went back on me. You went back on me, Dad. It's like you tricked me, you lied to me. I thought you were with me, and now you want to kill this deer. You went back on me. And this is the speech that brings the movie home that Penny Baxter gives his son.
Jody. Life goes back on you. A man's heart aches seeing his youngins face the world, knowing they got to get their guts tore out the way his was tore. I wanted to spare you long as I could. I wanted you to frolic with your yearling. I know the lonesomeness he eased for you. But every man is lonesome. What's a man to do? Only one thing to do. Take it for his share and go on.
This monologue was astounding to me. This is when I realized, the film has been leading to this the whole time. It goes back to that craftsmanship thing you were saying.
Yes.
But also, this, again, random 1994 CBS TV movie is really elevating itself thematically and speaking to things that I'm getting like emotional.
I as a father, you as a father.
Yeah. And that's what it is. It's looking at my daughter and thinking, how do I protect her from anything and everything so that she never has to go through the things that I've gone through? The heartache, the existential terror, the horrible decisions that I've made, the betrayals that I've experienced. I don't want her to do any of that. And you look at your child and you think that, but you also know at the same time what Penny is sharing here. That's life, though. I can't keep that from her. I can't make her avoid it. I have to let her go through it. And that ripping apart as a parent that you experience when you look at your child and you love them so deeply and all you want to do is help them avoid pain, you also have to think, pain is what has shaped me. Pain is what has helped me. And my kids have to go through that as well.
I tell my children, I tell my daughter, I tell my students, you know, a diamond is not made in ease. A diamond is made in heat and pressure. And a diamond is made in hell.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lump of coal before it goes through the fire and the pressure. And when it comes out and it goes through all that and it cools, that's when you have the diamond.
Yeah.
You know, this is the crucible of life. That moment where, and not to get too personal, but Tim, I swear on everything that walks, runs, or flies, I had this same conversation with my daughter a week before I saw this film over, you know, things that we've been dealing with over here in the real world. And I told her, we sat outside and I was sitting on my back porch and I said to her, I'm sorry. I wish I could protect you from this, but I can't.
Hmm.
I can't protect you from this. And I'm sorry. And she understood. She accepted that. You know, one of the things I always feared going into fatherhood was deification. Deification of parents is one of the most, in my opinion, people are free to disagree with me, it's one of the most damaging and potentially destructive things you can do to a child. Because if parent, it's stunting. If children cannot see your humanity, where are they supposed to learn it from?
Yeah.
You know, they, to be able to tell, you know what it is to tell my child, I'm not strong enough, or I'm not, or nothing I could do, no matter how strong I am, can shield you from this that you're experiencing. All I can do is be here for you while you experience it, but I can't stop it. I can't make it go away. I can be here for you, but I can't stop it. And it breaks me to the core because I wish I could, but I can't. And you know, it's a humbling moment, and we'll you know, you'll experience if you haven't already, because it's part of our arc as fathers and in the real world. There will be a moment where you're not going to be able to shield your child from the reality of the world. And she will accept it more readily than you will.
Yeah. Just like I did with my own parents.
Right.
The cyclical nature of childhood, adolescence, coming of age, adulthood, and then passing on that experience. It is built into this film. It's built into Phil's performance. It's built into each of our lives. And the whole thing reminded me, and I went back and read it, and I want to read a section, but a few years after Philip Seymour Hoffman died, his life partner, Mimi O'Donnell, wrote an article for Vogue. And I wanted to read the last two paragraphs that she wrote.
It's been almost 4 years since Phil died, and the kids and I are still in a place where that fact is there every day. We talk about him constantly. Only now we can talk about him without instantly crying. That's the small difference, a little bit of progress that we've made. We can talk about him in a way that feels as though there's a remembrance of what happened to him, but that also honors him. We talk about his bad sides and his good sides, what he did that was funny and what he did that was crazy, and what he did that was loving and tender and sweet. We open up, and it brings us together and keeps his spirit alive. This fall, after a long campaign by my kids, I agreed that we could get a family dog. They had their hearts set on a French bulldog, and after some research, we found a breeder and picked out a puppy, a girl, whose picture was so cute it was almost insane, and I'm not a dog person. The moment we made the decision, Cooper said, "She's going to die. Dogs don't live very long, so we're going to see her die." In her birth and in her coming to us, we were also mourning her death. Something about that felt right, knowing that everything you meet or love is going to die. I was in awe of my kids, that they were able to hold both things in their heads at the same time. That's who they are now. And it hasn't stopped them from loving this little creature, her name is Puddles, scampering around our apartment. None of them wants to hold back. They've given their hearts to her without hesitation or reservation. They're all in.
Do you have any final thoughts, statements about Philip Seymour Hoffman or about the film before I jump into our end credits?
I think I have to say that when you really, one may wonder why somebody of PSH's stature, even though he was young, coming out of an Oscar-winning film like Scent of a Woman that got so much, I mean, this is a guy whose star was really on the rise, took the risk of going back to television, which is usually a kiss of death. Usually what happens with TV actors is they can never come out of TV. there's got to be something about his instinct that he read this script and he said, yeah, I want to do this. Because and now watching this film, I understand why Philip Seymour Hoffman would have decided to be in this film. Like, and give it all of the, and give it his all the way that he did, even though, like you said, it wasn't a flashy part. It wasn't long. It wasn't big. He wasn't even a headliner. And he's like, no, but I want to be a part of the story. And I think that all of us as artists, and if you're actors in the craft, when you take on a project, ask yourself, why am I dedicating my time to this project? Is this a story I want to help tell? You know what? I've seen roles where I'm like, you know what? My role is small in this, but the story's so good, I just got to be a part of it. That's the gold you have to mine for. You know, that's how you can do more and get that breadth of experience. You know, if you try to be the lead in everything, you're going to work a lot less. And you know what's going to happen? You have a lot less experience and you're going to have a lot less opportunities to develop that comfort in self that an actor like Philip Seymour Hoffman was able to develop simply due to the sheer breadth of access to performance opportunities he created for himself by not limiting to himself to being the star of the show every time.
That's That is sponsored by One County Film, an independent film company telling stories with authentic characters and unique settings. You can rent our debut feature film, Palace, on Amazon right now if you're interested. That's That is produced by me, Timothy Mark Davis, and edited by Ryan Arnst. Our show music was composed and edited by Jessica Ray Huber, and our graphic was designed by Drew Hannigan. You can connect with One County Film on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at One County Film. You can connect with me on Twitter at Timothy Mark DAV, Timothy Mark Davis without the IS, and Instagram at Timothy Mark Davis. Carlos, where can the people connect with you and follow your work on the webosphere?
Well, if people would like to follow me, I am on Facebook and Instagram. You can follow me on Instagram as The Real Carlos Alayeto, and also at my website, www.carlosalayeto.com. And that last name is spelled Alayeto.
Beautiful. And we'll have Carlos's information in the show notes as well. So thank you for listening to That's That. And we'll see you next week with an in-depth look into the posthumously released 2014 film, A Most Wanted Man, which stars Philip Seymour Hoffman in the lead role, was directed by Anton Corbijn, who has directed music videos for U2, Arcade Fire, Coldplay, Metallica, Nirvana, Red Hot Chili Peppers, and Bryan Adams, among many others. Also stars Robin Wright, Rachel McAdams, Daniel Brühl, and Willem Dafoe. Here's the logline from IMDb. A Chechen Muslim illegally immigrates to Hamburg, where he gets caught in the international war on terror. A Most Wanted Man is currently streaming on Prime, and my guests will be Kinsley Coons-Whitworth and Andrew Paul Davis. So please watch the film. That logline is better than the Yearling logline, but you can watch the film on Prime and then join us for an episode discussion. It's an underrated gem. Phil is rocking a German accent, and it's got one of my favorite Phil moments at the very end of the film. Carlos, before we leave, I need the guest to quote Adam Sandler from Punch Drunk Love in a line he says to Dean Trumbull, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman. And the line is, "That's that, mattress man."
That's that, mattress man.
That's that, everybody.